Did anybody not get a handout? All right. I don't know why, but I was doing some thinking last Sunday, and I decided that we would probably just continue on with our discussion from last week because, I just sort of felt it was important. I think it's a topic that we don't talk enough about and we don't go into depth about. So if you remember, if you were here last week, we began a consideration of freedom. And last week, I just called it appreciating freedom. In other words, what are the qualities necessary for freedom to exist? How can those things erode? What do we need to do in each generation to understand the importance and also the structure of freedom? What do we do to preserve it, pass that along? All right, so we're going to do a little bit of review first, just so we bring everything together. Just to start off, I'm convinced that this is important because, and we'll look at this a little bit more in detail shortly, but I'm convinced that this is important because this is not the kind of material that a person is just naturally going to look into and study. You don't wake up every morning and think, what does it take to preserve civilization? What does it take to preserve freedoms in a civilized society? You wake up, and if you think about anything, you think about, what do I need to do to get to work? How do I need to prepare for work? How do I need to take care of my family? You think of countless other things every day before you think of, what does it take to ensure freedom, to preserve freedom, to make sure that my sons and daughters or grandsons and granddaughters understand in age-appropriate ways what freedom should mean to them. So because we don't think about it, because we never really give it any considered study, most of us go through our lives relatively ignorant about this. Now, I don't mean that in a disparaging sort of a way, but it's just we don't spend a great deal of time thinking about freedom. And here's what happens as a result of this, and this is very foreign to those who founded our country. But what happens is that the process of being the stewards and the caretakers of our freedom and making sure that somehow it gets passed on to the next generation falls to a handful of people that in a different sort of a way we would call professionals. They're the people who make sure that they look out for our freedoms for us because we're too busy taking care of the lawn and the flowers and going to work and doing all that other stuff. Here's a question. Can we trust a fraction of 1% of the people to look out for what's best for the majority of us? And yet you'll very clearly see that is precisely what happens. So, and apart from perhaps if during school, and I'm not sure what they might have called it then, but maybe you had a few civics classes, if you went on for any further education, you would have gone perhaps, if this was your field of study, you would have gone into what might be called political science, and you would have studied that field, what it means to be a public servant, what it means to look out for the public trust and the public good. But apart from that, most of us don't know this. And here is the premise that underlies all this. If you do not know how to be a free person, you will soon lose your freedoms. Look at that. Jim's here for 3 minutes, and he's already noticed that my cup is empty.
Most people are selfish. Just so you know.
Okay.
They don't look out for each other. They look out for themselves.
You, on the other hand, are demonstrating this by looking out for my well-being. I appreciate that. Okay. He probably did. But he knows I have nothing to give him, so he didn't do it with any ulterior motive in mind. All right. So we've already covered the first point or so, but we'll just read through these quickly. The qualities of human government which make collective and individual freedoms possible is something which must be learned and passed on from generation to generation. Let's stop right there. How many of you have children at home? How many of you have grandchildren? If you do, the question has to linger in your mind, how do I ensure that they will understand what I understand? And here's what I believe. And we'll get into this in a few more minutes. No, that both of them are yours. I got that for you. There's no better place to learn this than in the home. We'll look at that in detail later on, but consider this. One of the things that I suggested last week was that true freedom requires not only that I be free to act, but also that I be free to experience the full weight of the consequences of my actions. That I cannot be truly free unless I can be free to experience the negative consequences of my behavior. And yet we live at a time and in a place, you're shaking your head in disagreement.
Not in disagreement. Most of our parents, I don't want to assume, most parents today out there, they don't want their kids to go through what they went through. I like when Warren Buffett said, whoa. I work hard, you work hard. Because there are lessons in that. When you make a mistake, there are lessons in that. Common sense comes when we make mistakes, but if we're not allowed to make them, and every time we do, there's somebody there to scoop us up and make sure that the consequences aren't really even relevant. You don't really learn anything. We, as Samuel Adams said, we live the hand that feeds us, and then we wonder when the chains of servitude show up. We pray that they don't weigh too much. That's how it goes.
Now, in an individual basis, what Jim said is valid and easy to see. Where it becomes a particular problem, and where society has to step in and they're not sure quite how to deal with this, is when I exert my freedom and the costs of my freedom, the negative costs, don't really fall heavily on me so much as they fall heavily on someone else. All right, so when I exert my freedom to express my, and we used this example last week, when I use my freedom to express my sexuality in various ways, at various times, with various partners, and the result of that is that I end up with various children, and yet I'm not so inclined to take care of those various children, where does the true cost and the burden of that fall? See, it's on the children, it's not on me. And so society steps in then and says, well, we can't let this happen. We can't let them experience those consequences. And I think most of us would agree that it's not fair to the children that they do experience those consequences, and yet we're torn by this struggle. How do we allow the natural cycle of cause and effect to play out, and at what point do we have to step in and intervene? And
when prison stops becoming a freaking... Because those guys...
I knew you would have an opinion on this, Jim.
Don't take care of their kids. People end up in prison someday. But it's 3 months in a clock, cable TV, one more thing. When prison becomes chain gangs and it hurts, and you go outside and you wear pink underwear, you get a sandwich, maybe for lunch, maybe a half a sandwich for lunch, and it hurts to go to prison, then people go, you know what, I really want to go back. But when it's better than what I came from, then prison's not even prison anymore, because it's inhumane. You give up your civic rights when you act like an animal. You give them up. I think the reason I'm so passionate about this is we had this conversation yesterday at work. When you act like that, you give up your human rights because you're no longer acting humane. And yet you want me to take care of you when you're acting like my pet dog.
Alright, now the problem with what you just said is that if you don't value your civic rights, because you've never known anything but to have rights, then you don't appreciate it when they're lost. You see, if you had no rights and they were then granted to you, if you lived in servitude and slavery and then freedom was granted to you and for the first time you were able to appreciate it, then you'd seriously notice when those things were removed. But if you have grown up in freedom, experienced nothing but freedom, perhaps even experienced freedom without the consequences to experience the consequences of your freedom, then you don't know any other way.
You don't miss your path.
All right. Do I have your permission to move on? Okay. All right. Point number two, the things which promote individual liberty are not immediately obvious or readily discerned. And by that I simply mean that freedom is not a natural condition, and the things which promote freedom don't seem natural. In other words, real freedom, as we suggested last week, requires that I place self-limits, self-discipline, and behave righteously on my own, because if I am unwilling to do that, then someone is going to have to impose their righteousness on me. Right? Now that doesn't seem natural, because my first thought when I think of freedom is what? If you were to ask your six-year-old, what does freedom mean to you? And they were to have some time.
I want to do it.
Now, if you were to ask, this is sad to say, but if you were to ask many people, if you were Waters and you were lived in Waters' world, and you went out and interviewed the common man on the street, and you asked him or her what freedom meant, I suspect that very often you'd get a similar answer. In other words, we've lost touch with what real freedom means, and because it's not readily discerned, it's not like gravity. Right? I don't need to be taught about gravity. I soon enough learn it. Right? It's a very good teacher.
Genuine freedom is that, though. Genuine freedom.
Explain that.
Genuine freedom. Freedom. Literal freedom. No one else on the planet. No one else around. I can do what I want, when I want, how I want. I offended nobody.
Well, that we discussed that last week. True ultimate freedom is only possible.
But freedom in a republic.
If you are the only person. You can only ultimately do what you want without any consequence if you are the only person. But then you would soon discover that you're still not free to do everything that you want, because no matter how free you are to fly, you can't. So every one of us has limitations as a human. This, again, is part of the dialogue that needs to take place concerning freedom that we're unwilling to have, because no one wants to say we have limits. Now, I don't like the fact that I have limits, neither do you, I'm sure, but we all have limits. Some of them self-imposed, some of them naturally imposed. Like I said, you can't fly, I can't fly, that's a limitation.
And the general notion of freedom is only good for me as long as it benefits me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even in this country. Well, if it benefits me, that's okay. Or if it benefits you, you like that. But what if it's different? Because I've told people already, you know what, you can say whatever you want. You have the freedom to say whatever you want. I have the freedom to punch you in the mouth. Okay? Just so that you know that that works in two different directions. And I understand that violence is the last resort of the incompetent. Okay, you're right. I'm no longer competent to dialogue with you. I'm out of ideas. So now I'm just going to knock you out. So I'm not saying that.
I'm not sure where this fits into the general trend of conversation for the morning, but just take it for what it is. And
because people like to they want to dictate freedom. They don't really want true freedom. They want to dictate their kind of freedom.
And we described that last week, ultimately, by saying that in the absence of love, freedom is ultimately impossible. And remember, we've defined love as the intentional interest in the life of another human being. In other words, unless I care about and I'm interested in you, then true societal freedom is impossible, because the only person I'm looking out for then is myself. And if I'm looking out for no one but myself, and you all are looking out for no one but yourselves, then no freedom is ultimately going to occur except by strength or manipulation.
In simplest form, that was the difference between the American Revolution and the French Revolution. We based it on biblical principles. You couldn't have a just society without these morals taking place.
Right.
The French Revolution was a violent overthrow of the dictatorship totally, and they didn't base it on any of those kind of principles. It became a bloody
Okay, we covered the third thing. The things which foster and sustain liberty are not those things which people readily look into or look out for. They are not things which most individuals seek to learn. Now, because that's true, we have to establish forums like this where we talk about freedom. And that's why I said I thought it was worth looking at this for a second week. Because you're going to go back out into your everyday life, and you're not going to intentionally look out for freedom. You're not going to ask a lot of questions about what makes freedom possible. All right. For that reason, and so following three comes four. For that reason, liberty once obtained takes on qualities similar to our ideas of fresh air or clean water. It appears to be ubiquitous and limitless. So people give little thought to it. In other words, because you are free, you have the luxury of not giving any thought to freedom. Now let's move back 75 years and we'll visit Soviet Russia. And we'll consider, do you suppose that the average citizen in Russia at that time gave any thought to personal freedom and liberty? I'm sure they gave a lot of thought to it because they had so little of it.
Can I interject this?
Sure.
Since you brought up Russia and freedom, I got a prayer request from our, you know, our parent organization, or someone's got to pray. This bill could be passed, this law. And here's the consequences. Well, yesterday it was passed. Putin approved it, and it sounds good because it's fine. You know, we have terrorists, we have these different groups in our nation, but there's clauses in there, or what it's done is now limited the freedom of religion in Russia that was open the past 20-some years since I currently fell. So, you cannot, in your, if you have a whole group of believers meeting, no non-believer can meet there. You cannot share on the street your faith with somebody, in the office with someone. If you rent a facility as a church, well, you're in trouble now because you don't own that facility. You are very limited now in sharing Christ in Russia. It's reverted back to where it almost was before. Freedom of religion, as of yesterday, has been really curtailed in Russia now. It's really going to curtail missions, it's going to curtail the Christians in Russia. Totally different.
All right. Let's just continue to read on. If something catches my attention that I really think is important, we'll stop on it. Even at that time, since they are unfamiliar with what protects and maintains freedom, they are not well equipped to protect or restore the conditions in which freedom lives. So, let's assume that there is a life cycle to freedom. And we said this last week, but let's not take for granted the fact that we could one day find ourselves, due to our own neglect and indifference, a less free people.
Those are children.
Huh?
Those are children.
All right, because learning about and learning how to promote and protect freedom are not the types of information which help normal human beings. Okay, we covered this one. In other words, you and I don't study this because it doesn't pertain to our daily lives. Now, this last one, we're just going to jump right down to the last one because I think this is crucial. For freedom to live long and bless many, it is the responsibility of the inhabitants of each generation and place to learn as much as they can and pass along those observations and stories and knowledge. And I think the three are critical. One of the great things that the scriptures do is tell stories to illustrate something. Now, sometimes, because we have a more Western view of things, we long for there to be just spelled out lists. Do this, don't do that. Here's how this works. Here's the theory about this. Instead, most things in this book are taught through story. And you'll see both the good examples, when people did things this way, it worked well. You'll also see the bad examples. Now, some people are just natural storytellers. My father was a storyteller, much to my chagrin and regret sometimes, because I remember hearing the same war stories 20 times. And that was only the 20 times that I actually paid attention. I'm sure they were told many, many, many more times. But stories serve a valuable purpose, even in your family, to illustrate points about freedom. And so, like we said, every generation needs to be able to share this with the next generation. How many generations does it take before something slips from memory? My premise there is that in as little as 50 years, you could lose what you had. I've used this example before, but you remember perhaps a number of years ago, Steven Spielberg set out on a mission to interview as many Holocaust survivors as possible and video them before they gradually died off. Why? Because he was afraid that unless we had firsthand narrative accounts of what happened that were very believable, not because they were told by a third party, that could be seen as having biased or influenced the story, but because they would be told by firsthand, those who firsthand experienced it, that the story and the moral of the Holocaust would not be easily lost. Now think about that. There's a man who's wise enough to understand that in 50 to 60 years' time, this story could slip from memory. And you see it happening around the globe now already, don't you? Well, the Holocaust didn't ever happen. Now, that can happen within the lifespan of people who still experience. So think about this. It's a big world. But in the same world, as people who are still alive, and I lived through it, I know it happened, there are Holocaust deniers that are saying, that never happened.
Well,
a commitment to manage hope and expectation for a better future has been replaced by we're living the best future that we could have ever imagined. In other words, for the average person in this country, even if life is some days difficult, and we're not going to disagree with the fact that life is some days difficult, but life is still so much better than it is for a large percentage of the world, that we have undertaken the job in this country of simply managing our well-being and the wealth that we already have, rather than considering that we need to continue to manage the opportunity that we have for hope for tomorrow. Those are two different things, and you can't, we've said this repeatedly, you can't hold two large ideas that almost seem to be in conflict with each other in your mind at the same time. So you can either think about the responsibility and duty that you have to preserve something, or you can simply think about relishing in and basking in and enjoying the fruits of that, of what you already have. Not even understanding that the only reason that we are able to enjoy some of these things is because there are generations that have gone before us that didn't get to enjoy them. Their commitment was to live toward the future and say, it's a worthy ideal to lay down my life on behalf of something that I might never attain. All right, so a couple of principles that we take away from all. Incidentally, is there anybody, and I'm going to put this caveat in, is there anyone except Jim who has something to say right now? Okay, so we'll quickly walk through the four principles, and then we're going to go back and we're going to review some of the things that actually are necessary. They're asked of us if we choose to be a free people or to continue to be a free people. So the first principle, freedom matters since it's the way in which human thriving is fully released. All right, so we'll stop right there and we'll say the purpose to this week's material, apart from some review and making sure that it's well solidified in our thinking, is to understand that freedom exists for a reason. That we don't just crave freedom for freedom's sake. Because freedom for freedom's sake, without a higher principle, means that we simply live for ourselves for the day. But there is something more important that God has in mind when He calls us to live as free people. We'll come back to that. Principle number two, freedom for the many, which includes the weak and the disadvantaged, is not a normal or naturally occurring condition. Now notice what I said there. For the weak and the disadvantaged. See, it's easy to be free if you're the strongest person in the room. Now, let's just think about it, because strength is not the only advantage. It's easy to be free if you're the wealthiest person in the room. It's easy to be free if you're the smartest person in the room. As long as you have some advantage that you can leverage, absent a condition that we're going to look at in a minute, as long as you have some advantage that you can leverage, you are the biggest, the strongest, the fastest, the smartest person in the room, and therefore you will be free. But it is God's ideal that freedom exists for all, and as we're going to look at in a minute, if all are not free, in the end, none of us are free.
Well, the point that you're making is that if I have something that you want, I'm free and you're not. If you're going to become a slave to me.
Unless I'm bigger, and then I'll come take it. And then you won't have it, and I will.
Take those five guys. Everything that Hillary preaches about gun control and all that stuff, I watched her get into her own car that she hasn't driven in 20 years, protected by at least five. If I have something that you want, I'm a gun.
All my point is that true freedom exists to bless all people, and that is one of the moral obligations. Okay, we'll spill over into the conditions for freedom. That is one of the moral obligations that is imperative upon all of us, is to not just be committed to our own freedoms, but to act as agents that help all people experience freedom. And that's a point all by itself, that when one thing does not uphold its responsibility, then something else steps in to fill that responsibility. All right, now, let's tie that right in with principle three and four. We want to get through this quick because we're still not off the first side of the first page. All right, so for freedom to be a general and not a special condition, it's essential that most of the members of a society are taught in the ways of freedom and then pass that information along. Principle number four, the responsibility for freedom stewardship is everyone's. That means, Jim, that you and I cannot simply excuse something and say, well, people used to read this book, but they don't. So long as you know that book, whether you like it or not, whether I like it or not, I am a steward of that, and therefore it is incumbent on me to speak in appropriate ways that will help to inform other people. I don't have a choice, because if we want freedom to last, we have to speak and in appropriate ways. I'm not shoving something down someone's throat, but I am introducing them to something that they might never have considered before. And that becomes my duty. I cannot say, well, that's somebody else's problem to do that. Freedom is placed in our hands. Sooner or later, you'll get to talk. Freedom is placed in our hands. It is our stewardship. It is up to us either to pass it on fully or to watch it die. Now, so again, to speak to that issue, and I don't have a lot of time, but I think this is why it's important that we have discussion about this because, okay, borough of Quakertown. If two people live in the borough of Quakertown, they're going to impose very few limitations on each other. If 10,000 people live in the borough of Quakertown, just by virtue of the fact that more people exist in the borough, my individual freedoms are going to be limited based on the number of people that exist there. Right? Now, we can turn this around and say that with 10,000 people, we can thrive more effectively than we can with only two people. So we can look at it that way, or we can rail against the fact that with increase in numbers comes a restriction in what I personally can do. And that's where we completely misapply the purpose to freedom. The purpose to freedom is not to make me happy. The purpose to freedom is for general human thriving. And if I look at the purpose for freedom as merely to be my ability to express what I want in my way and get what I want, then I've misused or actually abused freedom. And it is people with that mindset that resent any kind of intrusion. And again, like you said, if we do not self-regulate, then an outside agency is forced to come in and fix the problem for us. If I can get along with my neighbor, if I can tolerate his fence, and I can say, you know what, I wouldn't have put a fence there, but if you want to put a fence there because that makes you happy, I can live with that. That's fine. As soon as the first person says, you know, I don't want fences in this town, then the borough has to pass an ordinance.
It's just, it's funny, because it's as simple as the
what are you laughing at?
I had to literally face that.
Oh, okay. Oh, okay.
You know, it's the not my bad job thing. All the liberals in California love wind power as long as that big thing is not in their backyard obscuring their view of the hills.
Okay.
Stick those things everywhere. Stick them everywhere. Anywhere the wind blows, plant one. I don't care. Why? Because God created the wind for us. It's free. He did it for us. It's free. Just put a big propeller in the sky, attach a wire to it, let it run. And it's free. We can't do that. Why? Well, because look at how gorgeous it is. You guys are nuts. You'd rather dig the shit out of the ground and labor like that than just build one of those and just let it run. Just let it run. It's free.
I think even in the, and I get the whole liberal and conservative thing, but even when we start to apply these labels and just relentlessly assume that these people believe this way. No, I know that, but isn't that the way we talk? And I'm as guilty of it as you are, but isn't that the way we talk? And when we do that, we pit ourselves against each other, and that doesn't serve human thriving.
It's just like the captain talking about the carbon footprint, and then he starts flying people all over the freaking world in his personal jet, takes his...
Boy, I don't know how we go so far afield in these discussions.
Because they talk about like it's okay for them, but not for me. That's what I talked about when we started this. It's okay for you, but not for me? No. It's either okay for everyone, or not okay for anyone. And I'll even let you pick.
Just remember, Jim, we can't miss you if you don't leave first. Okay.
So, freedom is okay for everyone. And I'll let you pick.
Have a good day.
Most people don't like how you say that, because the way I live, it's a
drawing question.
What time did you get up today?
I want to hear it close first. There it goes. Okay. we're not disagreeing with anything he said. It's just he gets excited. That's good. That's really good. Okay. So here's the first condition for freedom. So we've looked at the principles of general freedom, but now we look at the conditions of freedom. And we said last week that the founders of this country had an assumption about individuals that they believed was a prerequisite to maintaining freedom. Anybody remember what that was? Without looking at point number one, the bottom. That a free people had to be a moral people. That unless people could agree on a standard of right and wrong, and unless they were willing to hold themselves accountable to that standard of right and wrong first, even before looking to their neighbor and holding their neighbor accountable, unless they were willing to hold themselves accountable to that standard of right and wrong, that freedom couldn't long exist. Now, why is that so? Okay, so anarchy soon follows a commitment to live solely for yourself. All right, or anarchy isn't always the condition. What's another condition that exists?
Chaos.
Well, chaos and anarchy, we're going to lump into the same idea. There's a totally different condition. It's that of a despotic ruler who has authority over everyone, and everyone lives essentially as his servant. So one of two conditions will persist if a moral people does not choose to govern themselves. That is, chaos, because everybody, as the book of Judges, we used that example last week, everybody does what's right in their own mind, right? And we wake up in the morning and none of us, we said last week, none of us says, I think I'm going to do today what's wrong in my own mind. We all say we're going to do what's right in our own mind. The problem is that we don't all agree on everything. And so we have to submit ourselves to some level of authority above us that says, this is right, this is wrong, and we agree to live under it. So the first condition that can persist if morality doesn't exist is anarchy. The other is despotism, that a few will control the many and most people will lose their rights because the few have all the control. And we can define control as wealth, power, anything that can be used to manipulate and control other people. All right. Everybody, anybody want to... Okay, we're good.
How does this... I mean, I'm sure there's probably everybody in this room you have to admit our government and what's happening right now. I mean, you were just discussing clearly about.
I'm not forcing this on current politics. I mean, if you draw that conclusion, that's up to you.
I mean, basically, the bottom line here is that there's that conflict right now. We have the left, we have the right. We have the conservatives, we have the liberals. They're all in for everything they stand for. The conservatives are all in. And at least the last 10 or 15 years that I can recall, it's a mess. So how can you just like make it simple for me? I don't know about anybody else. How can this work together? Like you said, we need to listen. We can't force this down their throat. You know, I mean, I'm really trying to get a grasp on this because in my life, my kid's future. I want to know, like, how can we use what the biblical stuff is and do what we're supposed to be doing in a simple form without getting too confused.
Okay, so let's let that question linger for a moment. Now, if I had the full answer to this, I should be running for political office. The reality is I wouldn't get voted for anyway because nobody really wants questions answered properly. They want what appeals to them. But you had something to say, so you have to swear that you're going to keep it concise.
It's real small, but there's a way that seems right to a man in his own eyes, but his own way is that, you know, the left wing is doing what they think is best in their own mind, the right wing is doing what they think is best in their own mind. Neither of them are agreeing to do what's best in God's view. So there's our problem. You know what I mean? They're trying everything to do everything outside of the fact that, you know,
I understand that. I mean, that's obvious. Everyone in this room understands that. But biblically, what can we do about, you know, let Caesar just... I really want to know the answer because that's the pressing question that's on everyone's mind.
And it's not as if it's a recent pressing question. So I don't want to keep using just our country as an example. All right, but study the history of the first 20 years of our country, and even leading up to the founding of our country. It's not as if all the men gathered in Philadelphia or gathered in some other location and they held hands and they all agreed There was vigorous debate because they did not agree. They did not agree about the difference between federal rights versus state rights. They did not agree about who was a citizen and who wasn't a citizen. Should black people be citizens and counted their vote counted or not? Should states be represented according to the total population or only the free population? And on went the debates.
If you didn't own land, you didn't have a voice.
Right.
They looked at Massachusetts as a separate, totally entity from Virginia. You know, they didn't see themselves as one coming together.
So please let's not ever assume that there was this happy day gone by where we all agreed and now we find ourselves in this mess only in the last 50 years. Right? So the question again that Dave is asking is how do we have civil discourse and come to some sort of an agreement? And I'm not sure that we ever will, because one of the assumptions that undergirds this is we have to agree on a set of standards of right and wrong. Right? It's one thing to say that we are a moral people, but what defines that morality? And so while we wouldn't say that all the founders were Christians, we would say that definitely all the founders had a biblical understanding and worldview and believed that the Bible was a central moral authority that they would yield their lives to. In other words, they would not impose their opinion on the scriptures, but rather they would allow the scriptures to impose its view on them and be led by that. Now that's a altogether different view.
We've got thousands stand by quietly while a handful wants to remove God from government, from schools. And there's a body called the ALCU that forces that to happen in the sake of a few for millions that have a different opinion.
Okay, now, there are two things at work there. Did you just hear what he said? The two things that are at work. First off, we have actually, as a people in this country, come to the conclusion that it is the majority, or the minority, that are the stewards and the caretakers of freedom. In other words, freedom isn't my job to regulate and monitor anymore. Freedom is some paid officials. That's the first danger. In other words, we have ceded rights to people to whom those rights do not belong. But whose fault is that? It's at least as much our fault because we were asleep at the wheel. And we just let people do it. But then the other thing that's in play that he described, he said they use the courts. What is that? That's a form of power, exactly like wealth or exactly like position or status, anything. The ability to use government against the people is a form of power. So, they've done exactly what we've described. If we want something to be different, and the longer, it's like the breakdown in your car, right? When the brakes are just starting to make that squeaky noise, and you ignore it, what happens? It gets worse and it gets more expensive and it gets more difficult to fix, right? If you address the problem when it's small, you have a hope of fixing the problem quickly and relatively easily. When you allow the problem to persist longer, it gets harder to fix. So to answer Dave's question, the longer we allow the problem to persist, the more improbable it is that it will be a fixable problem. And if it is fixable, it might come at a great cost. It's not going to be a financial... Well, it might actually be a financial cost, but it's going to cost more than that. All right. We still haven't answered your question, Dave. Because it was a deep question. All right. Freedom demands responsibility. I am responsible to preserve it even at the temporary cost of my own liberty. So there's the next answer. Who is freedom for? Freedom is for everyone. But how do most of us live? Freedom is for everyone, but I'd prefer to be a little freer than you. Now, we don't say that. We just live that way. Freedom is for everyone, but if for you to experience freedom, I need to throttle back my willingness to or my desire to live free, then I'm not so sure I want to do that. Now, what is, if we choose to live by a biblical morality, what does God call us to do? Remember that verse that says, you have been set free in Christ, but do not use your freedom to serve yourself, but to do what? To serve others. Your freedom has been granted to you so that you can use it toward the best interest of others. Sounds suspiciously like the definition we use for love. Which is why we said last week that it is impossible to retain freedom without a commitment on the part of freedom's holders to love each other. So to answer your question, to start to answer your question, does it look and feel in this country at this time as if we actually love each other?
No.
Good answer, Fran. Good answer. Now, I know that if you were to have a political debate and you were to introduce the idea that without love, freedom is impossible, people would laugh you off the platform. But yet, with a biblical understanding of what love is, I believe that freedom is impossible without a commitment to love.
The more you talk, the more the frustration of such idiots we have.
Easy, easy. That sounded like a label to me. Idiots.
It's just amazing that somebody, it just never ceases to amaze me what it takes to be a president.
Remember, no one wakes up in the morning and does what they think is wrong in their own eyes. That's an important truth to remember, too. That as much as we say, those idiots, how could they think like that? We assume, for the most part, that honestly, when they wake up in the morning, they think they're doing the right thing. Now, exactly like your children, they can think they're doing the right thing and they're seriously misguided, too. But this is the first, if you want to have a civil discussion, you can't start it with the phrase, listen here, you idiot. I'm just suggesting that if you wish to have a civil discussion, I'll pass on. I don't know if you saw this or read anything about this, but I think it was University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill just passed this, it's microaggressions. Yeah.
Christmas, you can't say that's a nice pair of shoes you have on.
Oh, you can't say anything like that because it might remind other people that they don't have nice shoes. So, no, I mean, this really was going to be official campus policy. It goes on down the line. You cannot wish somebody a Merry Christmas or even a Happy Hanukkah or anything like that because it would remind people that there are differences between people and might stir up hostilities, and therefore we want to avoid that. In other words, you couldn't even, here was another one, you couldn't say that you didn't know a gay or transgender person because that would make them feel marginalized because they weren't known, that they didn't count as part of society. And so there was all this list of things that were, and this was intended to be school policy, and but for the fact that the switchboards just lit up with people calling, right? Probably like the people who pay for the college to have, those people called and said, this ain't happening here. And so I forget who it was, the dean or somebody said, okay, we cannot make this official college policy. However, we will leave it on the website and it will be a recommended guideline for behavior on campus.
Well, you see, we've left people in charge, the minority, don't have common sense anymore. We expect them to govern and rule. But this is what you're talking about. We need to remember this is our country. This is our voice and we need to make it known. But we're passive. We're sitting back because everything's pretty good. We're okay with it.
Well, here's the thing, and here's, before anybody else says anything, I want to make sure that you hear this. This policy, this collection of policies, was not drafted by the adults. This collection of policies was drafted by the students. Now, what does that say about what has happened in just one or two generations about the understanding? So before we point the finger too heavily at them, where were the homes and the parents in which those children were raised to speak something of freedom into their lives?
Did a draft of that.
Yes.
I was like, yeah, like, why wouldn't we know that? You know what I mean? Like,
and you cannot hold, I know this is going to be uncomfortable, but you cannot hold a 21-year-old responsible for the primary formulation of his opinions. Something went into the formulation of those opinions and ideas. You understand what I'm saying? It's the adults of a generation before that uploaded that information into these students to cause them to start to think in a certain way. Now, at some point in time, they become responsible for their own actions. But remember, they're still at an institute that is commissioned to help them learn. Think about that. They have acknowledged the fact that they need to learn more and have therefore placed themselves at the disposal of professional educators who are there to guide their education. And so under the guidance of the adults and with the input of parents and teachers from earlier education, this is what they've crafted. So we can't hold them totally responsible. Which comes back to this simple premise that you and I are the caretakers and the stewards of freedom, and if we do not pass it on wisely and well to the next generation, it can easily be lost.
Correct.
Now, to speak to what Dave said, and this is why we need to have what I'll call robust conversations about biblical values. It is not enough to say to a kid, this is right and this is wrong. You know what the question for a two-year-old is, right? What's the favorite question of a two-year-old? Exactly. And what is the fallback answer that most parents use? Now, why did we have so little struggle in defining that? And nobody had a different answer.
Because Glenn said so.
And so when we don't know, or when we're sick of answering whys, and in all fairness, because children do have a lot of whys inside of them. But we need to have age-appropriate and significant, intelligent conversations with our children about what it will mean to live in certain ways. It's not enough just to say that God said so. Remember how we've defined God's law? We've called it God's law of love. Why? We don't just call it God's law. We call it God's law of love, or at least we do here. Because it is not an arbitrary collection of recommendations intended to see how high we'll jump, how far we'll jump, and what will endure. It is God's intentional written commitment to us to help us to thrive. And until we believe that, we cannot explain that well to our children. Now, if you were to go out into, okay, we're going to play Waters World again here, and we're going to send Waters out onto the street, and we're going to ask him to ask 100 people, do you believe that God's law as revealed in the Bible is helpful for people or a hindrance to them? Did anybody hear what I said, or were you all paying attention to something else? Okay, and what do you suppose would be the answer? No, God's law is restrictive, it's outmoded, it's out of time, it's out of date, it's not really intended for human thriving. Somehow we've missed an opportunity to share with people this message that these laws are intended for our own benefit and blessing. All right. Am I at least nibbling away at the edges of the thing? I know I'm not going to answer it. I just want you to know that.
Our public officials are the caretakers of our future in this country. So when you go to vote or you don't vote, whether you're left or right, whatever your side is, it's critical that the people that we're voting on have to have that fundamental thing. So, I don't mind being a voter.
No, you are the caretaker. I have to disagree with you. You are the caretaker. They are the hired servants,
right,
which
right.
You have sent off to do your bidding.
Right.
But exactly like delegating anything else, if you delegate something and then don't follow up on it and check on the results, what happens? Have you ever delegated a test to your kids? What happens if you don't follow up?
Sure.
Well, that's exactly what we've done. We have delegated the task of running the country to hired people. That's all they are. I mean, I know they think more of themselves than that, but they're hired people. We hired them to go do some work. But then we turned our back on them and went back to doing what we wanted to do. And then we're shocked later on when we find the country in a mess.
I'm shocked right now to tell you that we have two candidates running for president that are a joke. And I don't know what anyone in this room is thinking, but like one's better than the other.
Surely, forget what anyone in this room is thinking. I'd like to know what people in the rest of the world are thinking. Really? The beacon of freedom and hope for the rest of the world, and this is the best you could come up with?
So here we sit, the dozen of us sitting here, and we haven't wondered who she is. So we know that.
The other one is in all Americans, is what we have.
I mean, obviously, we know if you're voting, that's where we're going, but it's just such a joke.
It's preposterous, it is.
And we sit there, and I'm like going to have to answer for this when I'm 70, so I'm like, how did this happen? We just sat here in the church, and we just went and we did our thing, so we didn't have any interruption. I can't believe we're in a situation
where we've been sitting for so long, we've been so passive for so long, we haven't left.
Okay, so that's part of the problem, but let's not fail to recognize another part of the problem. It's not as if good does not have an enemy. Okay, it's not as if every morning good wakes up, stretches, gets out of bed, and says, well, I think I'll go live my life today. Good is constantly at war with good's enemy, which is evil. Okay, and so every day we are not just vigilant to protect good, we have to be vigilant to war off evil.
Now, that's why I brought up Russia. That's on the way here. We say, oh no, well, yeah. Wake up. We sit by nothing, and our rights and freedoms are slowly taking away from us.
I think there's another option here. Just, I mean, right now, I haven't heard one news agency say that he is the projected candidate for the party. Maybe praying every day.
What's that say again?
Not the actual candidate of the Republican Party. There's a word.
Okay. We can't turn this into a complete political debate. So every day, Dave is saying that he wakes up and he prays that Donald Trump falls over dead of a stroke.
No, that's not it. I'm not saying at all.
It was a joke, Dave. Relax.
But it shows you how he has an accord with people, because many things he says, people are thinking and won't want to say out loud.
That's right.
Yeah. Because there's a big group of people that are exasperated, frustrated with America.
Yeah. A lot of people think it's something radically different that's got to make some kind of change, whether it's good or bad, and it's bad, we'll fix it later, or it's the same old stuff as usual.
I believe that a president is a reflection of the people's heart. You know, and if you look at Donald Trump, when it's established, you know, money. You know, people have become, you know, worshippers of money, worshippers of all that. And I think, honestly, that Trump's going to be president, because, you know, unless, you know, some kind of miracle happens, you know, this country, you know, serves a god of money.
But is there anyone here that's actually prepared? So I'm not praying for one. I'm saying praying for God to reveal His will, and I can't believe that. But that's what it is. Like, you know, there are people who don't have a voice that could step up. You know what I mean?
To assume that this is not God's will is to assume that God is powerless to effect change. To assume that this is not God's will is to assume that at some point in time God doesn't say, and I believe this phrase is true, people get leaders that they deserve.
Yeah.
And also, God's plan for all of eternity.
Yeah, go on.
In America.
Yeah, it is. It is. Yeah. It's much bigger.
Yeah.
It just kind of goes without saying that, you know,
all right.
It'll come to you.
Yeah.
Let's just very quickly move on. Remember what we've said. This is the main principle for today. That there needs to be a purpose for freedom. Freedom is not just a quality that we seek to gain for its own sake. We seek to be free people because in that freedom, we have the best chance for human thriving. And then we went further and said that unless all of us are free to thrive, none of us are ultimately free. And we'll talk about that in a minute, but you can say, think about this for a minute, and we'll look at it in terms of a public welfare state. Are those who are footing the bill for those who are free to not experience the consequences of their behavior, are they really free? In other words, when we help some people to thrive without assuming responsibility for it, are the rest of us really free? No. Real thriving requires that we lift up the disadvantaged and help them to be participants in that thriving. Not to be participants. Okay, let's move on. We're actually going to get to today's material finally. That's good news. We got 15 minutes to go. All right, just want to read this phrase. It would be on the front side of your second page, I think, if I got that right. Freedom is not an end to its in its own. I don't know if that's where you are or not, but if not, fine there. All right. A little bit of a typo here, but the ultimate question which protects human freedom and enhances human thriving is, will, and that should be my attitudes and actions in this matter, enhance the prospects for others to live more fully and bountifully, or will my attitudes and actions enhance my life experience at the expense of others? Now, what if you woke up every day and asked that question? What if that governed your decisions throughout the day? Now, we have to define that. What does it mean to live more fully and bountifully? And this is where we return to God's law of love. This becomes our guideline that we voluntarily submit to. Here's another principle that we need to take. Free people must all submit. It's simply a question of what you decide you will submit to. Every person will submit to something. You'll either submit to yourself and your own pleasures and your own ideals, or you will submit to something else. So everyone submits, but free people are those who have chosen to submit to something that will ultimately bring them life. But it's not going to bring you alone life, it is going to bring life to others. Several weeks ago, we looked at the question that I posed, how does the gospel message really spread? We're going to tie this in with what we're looking at right now. And we said this, that so long as there is a common foundation of understanding between peoples, the gospel message could spread based on information and doctrine. You believe this book, I believe this book, we can have a discussion, I can help you to see the gospel in this book. But what happens when we step outside that common foundation? What happens when the gospel needs to spread across cultures, across language barriers, across all sorts of other barriers that separate rather than unite us? How does the gospel spread in conditions where we are divided rather than united? What was the simple answer? That's it. The gospel spreads because of love. That people start to understand the doctrine based on experience, their experience of being loved by other people. That's the condition that allows the gospel to spread. So, here's the question. If we want freedom and thriving to spread, how would we see that spread? Through the advance and the championing of genuine love. Now, incidentally, it's not loving to let you do whatever the heck you want if it's self-destructive. And so that's a critical distinction. Our love, this is our choice. Our love, if we choose to submit to it, is going to be guided by this book. Therefore, certain things that other people will do, certain behaviors, certain attitudes are going to work against them. We need to try to steer them away from that. So would it be loving to allow your 12-year-old to do everything he or she wanted? No, it wouldn't. And in the same way, we shouldn't assume that simply because someone has reached some arbitrary age of adulthood that they actually have the intelligence to choose well for themselves, right? Put this to the test in your own life. Since the time you were 21 years of age, have you ever chosen badly in a way that worked out poorly for yourself? Right? Therefore, we've all proven to ourselves that we are capable of choosing badly. This guides us in how we help to choose for ourselves and how we express love to others. All right. Where does this take place? We're going to look at the three institutions. We've talked about this before: family, government, and the church. If we want to see freedom prosper and thriving occur, we need to be diligent about caring for each of these institutions. What are the benefits of the family? How does family fit into this whole equation of preserving freedom? Okay, I'm going to make a politically controversial statement right here, but the family is also the source or the origin of life. That is, that when a family is structured, sort of, we'll say, the right way, and it has the right biological beings in the family, that life can be produced. Now, you just sort through that on your own time and figure that out.
It's but God's the first institution, the family, is his first.
And so the next generation comes from family. All right. Now, why else is family important? So the family brings life, literally, the right kind of family structure. What else does family do then? Family is the first testing ground and proving ground where I start to explore what freedom is. Family is the place where you and I are most free to pass down our values and understandings about things. Family is also the safest place to experiment with true freedom, which also means experiencing the consequences of freedom. Children who don't experience the natural consequences of their actions in family will sooner or later have to experience the consequences of their actions. So ask yourself this. If you were a loving human being, would you prefer to have your children experience consequences at home while they were young and the situations were redeemable, or would you rather allow them to experience consequences as adults where the cost would be more costly and the likelihood of redemption was smaller?
The problem is the family is broken. Big time. Family's broken big time.
You know, that's just your mantra for the morning. Every time we say something, you see a problem in it, don't you?
It's a fact. It's broken. There's kids in foster homes. I've had them in my house. You know, going back to the same thing. Everyone's got to pitch in and help with that.
Not all families, but a lot.
I know, I didn't say all. Yeah, I said family in general.
Jesus said that house divided against itself can't stand. You know, that's the problem with even your brother and your sister and your father and your mother can't even see eye to eye. You know what I mean? So if you can't see eye to eye with just your people, it's going to be, you know, that's where everything breaks down. If it doesn't happen there, or willing, you know, some kind of community or something, you know, like a better community, want to see and learn about God, you know, but not being brought up in it, you know, was not so good.
Okay. You can read the notes, what's left of them that we haven't talked about. Let's move on to the next of these three, which is civil government. So what's the purpose to civil government in a thriving and free society? And I'm posing the question because we need to be able to grapple with this and understand it. You and I have perhaps many understandings about government. We talk about the government as if it's something remote from us, something out there that does things that we have no control over. What is the purpose of civil government?
It should provide structure that people can accomplish things together rather than individually.
Okay. So we can look at the four things that, that, or the four roles of government that I put down here, provide order and structure. In other words, some basic guidelines for how we behave in society. Right, the simple example is that of the traffic light. Okay, when it's green, you go. When it's red, you stop. Now, we could just enlarge that illustration and look at it in a lot of ways. That's the purpose of government, to facilitate good interaction between people. The next one, mediate problems which have not been resolved in the family or the church. And we see a lot of that. And unfortunately, what we see is problems that haven't been mediated in the family. Right, just think of divorce court, think of child custody, right? Why does the government need to be involved? Because family didn't do its job well. Because the participants in family never really bothered to ask the question, what would be best for the thriving of all, not just for my thriving? Matter of fact, except for some occasions, and I'm going to throw that caveat in, most people would be better off remaining married and pursuing thriving within that first relationship, because it's not all that common that you see people that get a divorce and move on to greener pastures that all of a sudden find thriving, right? What they find is just a different kind of chaos and misery. Well, okay, the third role of government, to accomplish public works which are good for all. Now, think about what that requires. What's good for all?
A lot of
opinions
on that.
Ah, and so we would have to, government draws us together. Unless we become frustrated with the process, throw up our hands and say, that's it. And when government does not draw us together to have civil discussion, not heated discussion, but when government does not draw us together to have civil discussion, guided up incidentally by the laws of love for each other. How do we talk to each other? According to the laws of love, respect, and dignity that are provided in this book. And that's how we have civil discussion, which means as soon as we depart from the guidelines provided for us about how to discuss things with each other, what happens? We open ourselves up to unfair conversation. All right. So, do we all know situations in which roads are built that go nowhere, bridges are built that go nowhere, public works projects occur because somebody needed votes and so they agree to do this for that and the other? Did they stop to ask the question, what will contribute to the thriving of all? Probably not. This is the role of government, to contribute to public works that will benefit the most people for the longest period of time. We've defined that as stewardship, incidentally. What is stewardship? The commitment to act in ways which will provide the most good for the most people for the longest period of time. And finally, to provide for our defense. So those are the four roles of government. All right. Simple question. Do we see government acting in roles outside of that today?
Sure.
Give me some examples.
Let's talk about the overreach of the EPA. A guy wants to dig a pond in his yard, and all of a sudden you got 50 officials telling him he can't do it. And it's got to be this deep, and you got to get a permit. You know, it's just things butting in where they have no need to butt in.
Okay.
There's states where you can't collect rainwater. I mean, really? Yeah. It's just absolute stupidity, and then you wonder why everybody gets fed up when they hear about these things.
All right.
There's a lot of irresponsibility, and I'm sure we could sit here all day and name thousands of things that they've done that they shouldn't be doing.
I'm going to suggest that some of those are personal and even secondary issues which people need to be able to peacefully and amicably work out. The water issue reminds me of a fence issue. And we're going to assume that every law that's on the books, for the most part, at one point, had some legitimate purpose. There actually, I know what you're talking about with the water thing, so I don't want to go down a rabbit trail there. Let's look at something bigger. Okay, I'm fishing for something, I'm not catching it, so I'll just tell you. I believe the government has started to intervene in becoming what I'll call a social architect. Government has started to take on the role of defining what family looks like, what society should look like, what freedom should look like, and even what people's personal values and morality should look like. To the extent that things which we would once have called abhorrent, things which we would once have called bad or evil, or take your choice of words there, we now are, at very least, it is suggested that we refrain from calling things by what we believe them to be, because that would be hateful. Now, no one wants to be hateful, right? That sounds like a bad thing. Who would want to be hateful? But the reality is that when government intervenes and starts to become a social architect, what it's doing is stealing from another institution's role. So now we'll look at the third institution, which is the church. So what's the role of the church? Because I want us to see how the three of these work together, and when they are out of balance, when they are not each firmly and consistently doing what it is their responsibility to do, then one of the other institutions has to intervene and pick up the slack from the third. Or when one of the institutions creates a vacuum and doesn't do anything, the others start to encroach. Big government becomes big. Why? Because the other two institutions don't do their job in the right way at the right time. Because government couldn't get big if it didn't have the room to grow bigger. Do you understand what I'm saying? Right? I mean, I think we're all reasonably well contained here, right? The fat person in the room couldn't get any fatter if there wasn't any more room in the room, right? Understand? Well, government couldn't get any fatter if there wasn't any more room in the room. We have allowed room for government to get fatter. All right, so what is the role of the church in all this? Okay, so the role of the church, it is several things. The church is the steward of the gospel. And if we believe that the gospel message has any ability to influence and provide hope for humanity, then we should take seriously this stewardship of the gospel. If you believe that the stewardship of the gospel is merely about something that will happen later on after people die, and it has no influence on what happens here, then perhaps we could be cavalier about the message of the gospel. Perhaps. But if we believe that the message of the gospel actually has import on people's lives and their freedom here and now, then whenever the church is indifferent or casual about its presentation and approach to the gospel, then what it is doing essentially is consigning people to live in slavery and bondage. All right, so how does the church do this? So Dave already said, well, we teach and we educate. What else do we do? Because a primary role in the family is teaching and educating. And I want us all to understand that. It is not the role of the church to act as the surrogate to do the work that the family is supposed to do. The church becomes the backstop for the broken family where that teaching is not occurring well.
Be an example.
Did you say give me an example? Or?
Be an example.
Okay.
Well, we're the Jesus representative on earth. We need to back up because the church is confused. We need to be convinced and committed that this really is the word of God, that we really do have the answer. And we can make a difference. So the church is confused about, well, that's right, that's wrong, that's not the Bible. But when that becomes a reality, yeah, we really do have an answer for people's lives.
And we should say this, because there's a lot of question today about, well, you'll know what I'm saying without my getting into detail. Are people born this way? Or
I'll be talking about that tomorrow.
Oh, my word.
We said, now what's happening? We're starting the series tomorrow. You asked for it. We're going to address that from the biblical perspective. Not what I think or I feel. What does the Bible say? What does God say?
And the simple and straightforward answer that I have for you about this, which is maybe different than John has for you on this, is this. In the end, it really doesn't matter if you and I are born in certain ways. It is our job to manage who we are. That the mere fact that you happen to be born with certain inclinations or desires doesn't mean that you should have free rein to exercise those desires. That if you were born with a desire, some of us are more angry than others. And I don't mean we're more angry because that was nurtured into us. Merely by personality, some of us are more angry than others. Some of us are more fearful than others. Does that give you a right to express your anger more vigorously just because you were born that way? And of course not. No one would say so. Some of us are born with certain attractions or desires. That doesn't mean we are free to exercise them. Because remember that question that we asked, that if we would all wake up every day and ask that question, could make all the difference. Is my attitude and my action today going to contribute to the overall thriving of those around me or only to my own betterment? And whenever you hear an argument used on behalf of, well, I'm this way and therefore I should pursue that, who is the focus of that? The individual. I will be better this way. I will have more freedom this way. And it never addresses the question, will all of us thrive? It only addresses the question, can I thrive? And I'm just going to leave you with this one final reminder, which is this. Until all of us thrive, ultimately none of us thrives. And I believe that's biblical. All right. I'm done.